Wednesday, August 16th, was another of those awake at 7:15 mornings. How weary and depleted it leaves me for the day. Lyndon and I watched Senator John Tower for the Republicans and Senator Joe Clark for the Democrats on TV, the Today Show, talking about Vietnam. And what a twist of fate it is to see this administration, indeed us, being explained, backed, yes, even defended by John Tower, while that red-hot Democrat, Joe Clark, slashes at the administration's policy with rancor and emotion. The wheel does turn. We brought Lynn in, and it'll be the last time for quite a while. And he lay on the bed and kicked and gurgled. Linda came down and sat beside us. She's so good with little Lynn, and she loves him dearly. But I had a 10 o'clock date with Mayor Akin. We drove around Washington, our first little park at 3rd and Independence, and Syfax School, where, praise the Lord, they have taken out the dead trees, and there are three or four teenagers weeding the plots down the double avenue of Magnolia Selangiana from Pennsylvania southeast, and of course past Liz's Strip, masses of flowers where the masses pass, Rawlins and Walt Whitman Park, while I gave Harry an explanation of what our little committee has tried to do in the 2 years and 8 months of its life, and what I hope for the city of Austin. The most imaginative and lively use of the waterfront, the development of Walla Creek, a strip of cool green through the city for several miles, as lovely as it is in the few blocks where it passes the university, and shopping centers that have the relief of some trees, some greenery. I respect his earnestness about his job and his devotion to Austin. I have no idea whether I made any impression. I left Nan Robertson's articles in his room and suggested he might want to read them to see the sort of climate the country was coming into all over, about the looks of cities. When I got back, I went in Lucy's room, and there was all the confusion of packing, open suitcases, Lucy rushing around madly, asking the maids if they'd seen this dress or those shoes. Staff here all loves Lucy. They call her baby, and it has no relation to the way Rep Brown uses the word baby. I had my lunch brought in on a tray. I spent the last several hours of Lynn's visit here just watching him and talking to Miss Cafella. I'd brought her in a framed picture, a White House book, together with some more effective evidence of my gratitude for her stay with us, because I hope she'll come back for things like Christmas, or, I hardly dare say it, another wedding in the family. It has been a joy to have her with us. The nicest time, I think, of all, during Lucy and Pat's and Lynn's visit, was Sunday night when we all sat around the dinner table and Lucy made some careless, very positive assertion about the passage of a sales tax in Austin, which obviously she favored. Thought anybody who didn't favor it was pretty dumb. And her daddy very calmly said, "Now, honey, you must remember this. You and I and Gene Williams and Helen can only just wear so much and eat so much. And in a sales tax, everything you wear or eat is taxed. Which one of us do you think is more capable of paying taxes? You and I or Gene and Helen? A sales tax really helps the rich people at the expense of the poor people." I wish I could remember it and explain it exactly as cogently, as simply as he did. And then we simply sat and listened, with the children interjecting questions every now and then, and Lyndon reminisced about his college years, when there were three terms, and each one the tuition cost $17, and every time it approached, he thought sure he'd have to drop out that time because he just simply couldn't raise the $17. Once Ben Crider had lent him $80, all that he had in the bank, and that had simply meant the difference between him staying another term. Another time, the Masons. He'd heard about a scholarship they offered for $200. He had written and applied for it, although his father was not a Mason, and they had granted it to him. He never knew quite why. And he had left school before he graduated to teach a term to make the money to pay it back. And then there was one time when he didn't see possibly how he could pay it, and Aunt Lucy had come to him with $3.60 and said, "I've been saving my egg money, and I want you to have it." And Dr. Evans, whose pay as president of the school was a mere pittance, had told him he just had got to stay in and he would find the money for him somewhere. And then Lennon went on to say how, in the last 2 or 3 years of Dr. Evans' life, when he was very old and retired and no longer quite alert, we had put him on the payroll of KTBC as a monitor, and he had carefully evaluated programs. The children listened enthralled, and every now and then they asked questions, and Joe, who knew nothing at all, I'm sure, of poverty, of need, was soaking it up. Lucy said, "Daddy, we needed to hear something like this." And indeed she does, because she lives in a soft cocoon there in Austin, with the children of rich people, a lovely street where ease and security prevailed. And, of course, as her mother, I am glad, but I recognize it is also dangerous in its own way. The children were leaving at 2:30, and Linda and Chuck went to the Queen's room a little before to tell Lucy and Pat their plans. And I was proud of the foursome as I stood looking at the door watching them. Barry and Linda and I went down to the South Grounds to see them off at 2:30, with much kissing and last farewells. And then, back upstairs in the Queen's sitting room, Linda and Chuck and I discussed their plans. His present period of duty at the Marine Barracks here in Washington will end around the first of the year, and he is asked to go to Vietnam, so perhaps that will be in February or March. There is usually a little lapse of time for a man to get his affairs in shape, called procedural leave, I believe. And so their big decisions are, when should the wedding date be, and when should they announce it? They're thinking of December the 9th, that is a Saturday, and nicely spaced between Thanksgiving and Christmas. And we'll give them, hopefully, something more than 2 months for a honeymoon and some life together in a little rented apartment here in Washington. And the big problem, the list, and who should be the minister? We talked of Reverend Sumner's, who had christened Linda and Lucy as well, and confirmed them. We talked of Bill Baxter. This much Linda Bird knows. She wants to be married in the White House, in a military wedding, with all the beauty and grace that a wedding can have. We got as far on bridesmaids as Lucy and Wari and Carolyn. One of the big problems will be to announce it before it gets announced in somebody's column. Hopefully not Maxine Cheshire's. Two thoughts flitted through my mind, one amusing, one sweetly sad. At the elevator, when I had run into George Christian and Tom Johnson, Tom had said, "Oh, we sure are gonna miss that boy, that little Lynn. He was a good story every day. With all the riots and the war, he was a big help. But the only other thing we could do now is to get Linda Bird married off." And I had smiled innocently. And the sweetly sad one was when I went in Linda's room, I noticed something different, and for several moments I couldn't decide what it was. And then, gone, gone, were all the pictures of George, the romantic, devilish one on the chest of drawers, the patrician, handsome one, and lots of other little mementos. A faded telegram pasted on the mirror. She had said no word of it. They'd simply been removed. Her daddy had promised to talk to her. He was having a business lunch and finished it about 3:30. Mm-hmm. He came in the Queen's sitting room, looking for once ghost-tired, and sat down heavily. And Chuck told him, in a very quick, straightforward fashion, what their aims and hopes were. The old-fashioned word is intentions, I believe, and not a bad word. And when Chuck used the phrase, "your permission," Lyndon quickly said, "You have it, and my love." But it wasn't the long getting to know you talk that I hope he and Chuck can have sometime soon. Earlier in the day, I had been to a ceremony in the East Room of Vietnam Civilian Service Awards that was moving and sweet. Former Ambassador Lodge was with us on the stage, and a small group of civilians, workers in aid, members, I believe, of a church group, received citations for their bravery and their dedication and their long hours in constructive work in Saigon, hospitals, schools, a gigantic effort quite apart from the war. Were there ever such people as Americans? Late in the afternoon, my weariness caught up with me. I went to bed at 5, and it was 6:30 when Ashton woke me. I made some decisions on the Ivory Coast luncheon, some late staff invitations for the next day, and then called up my house guests to welcome them and to say, "Let's go bowling, anybody that's interested." Brownie McNeil and his wife, and Emma Long, and Herman, and Bess, and their son Mark, walked with me through the Rose Garden and over to the bowling alley, and we had about 3 good games. There's no telling when Lyndon will come for dinner tonight. Mm-hmm. He's in a regular maelstrom of work. Senators and congressmen, a group at 6, and at 7, some columnists, and at 8, some bureau chiefs. They would be upstairs in the yellow room. And so I had chosen the balcony off of the blue room to sit with our house guests. Jerry and Crockett English arrived with their cute son, Wilkie, and Stuart Long came moseying in. And we spent a warmly pleasant 2 hours with the Jefferson Memorial glowing like a great pearl in front of us, and the tall, strong shaft of the Washington Monument, and a full moon. 3 of these couples I have known for 20, 30 years. And the Brownie McNeils had been a part of that most wonderful trip down the Rio Grande and singing around the campfire. So there was much to talk about. Bessie's appointment by Lyndon to the Committee for Retarded Children, and with Emma Long, the makeup of the city government of Austin, the plans, the personalities. I had put copies of Nan Robertson's articles in her room and asked her to accompany us the next morning when we went out to see Project Trailblazers. I hope very much that Austin and those that run it will grow in interest, in knowledge, and enthusiasm for this whole wide spectrum of beautification, for everything that it can mean for a city. And so I'm using this time up here to expose Emma to some of it. Yeah. One of the most delightful things about it was the simple, unabashed delight of my guests in being in the White House. And they couldn't have been more delighted than I was to have them. Jerry said, "I've been hoping you'd ask me for years, but I'm at the ranch. I never thought you'd ask me to the big house. I'm going to have it tattooed on my chest." She's just as pixie and gay and funny as she was in the campaign of 41. That has been 26 years ago and doesn't actually look much older. And we reminisced about that real time of crisis in our personal lives, Lyndon's and mine, when Jerry returned from overseas with the Red Cross and spent the night with us at 30th Place. During the night, I became very ill but didn't tell anybody, and the next morning went to the hospital with a ruptured tube. It had been a tubular pregnancy, undiagnosed. And Jerry found herself staying on, taking care of Linda Bird. And then Brownie McNeil brought out his guitar and played for us some of the songs I had loved so much. Shenandoah and Rancho Grande and Guadalajara. What a different setting, the balcony off the blue room, and sitting around the campfire on Navajo blankets under the great escarpment along the Rio Grande. And both nights had a full moon. At the appropriate moment in one of the Mexican songs, Jerry came forth with this wild shriek, rather like a rebel yell. "A real grito," Brownie said. And she said, "That's the way you feel when you're born and raised in El Paso." It was 10:30 when Lyndon came out after his meeting with the bureau chiefs and joined us, and we went straight up to dinner, where in spite of his weariness, he was warm and interesting and giving out, and I was so proud of him. It was past 12 when we said goodnight to our house guests, and he to his night reading, and I to sleep. There were 2 gifts from the day, besides the pleasant memory. One was a little envelope full of square-headed nails, handmade, that Emma gave me. They'd been used in the capital of the state of Texas in 1882 and removed in some recent reconstruction. And the other was a tape of Brownie's songs.